Welcome inside Appalachia. I'm Cecilia Mason. Folks in fracking country, Pennsylvania, work on air pollution issues.
You can see the gray smoke. Steam
wouldn't leave that gray.
Kentucky college students are having a blast with some mine research.
We're incorporating blast-resistant technologies for mining applications, for Department of Defense, for Homeland Security.
America's Test Kitchen has an Appalachian connection.
It was a great place to grow up. And I think that gave me a sense of myself.
And we learn about the famed Fairfax Stone.
Well, the Potomac Stone was where the surveyor for Maryland, William McCullough Brown, claimed was the true head spring of the Potomac River.
These stories and more coming up this week on Inside Appalachia. You're Inside Appalachia. I'm Cecilia Mason. The debate over natural gas drilling in Pennsylvania has turned small rural communities into battlegrounds where frackathists clash with industry and neighbors with neighbors. Debates in fracking communities have mostly focused on issues like noise, traffic, groundwater pollution, and the chemicals used in the process. But a small group of residents in Susquehanna County, Pennsylvania, is leaving that debate behind in an attempt to do something tangible for their community. As State Impact Pennsylvania's Katie Culinary reports, their efforts are focused on air quality.
2 years ago, Victoria Schweitzer had stopped speaking to her neighbors. Schweitzer was one of the residents of Dimmock, who claimed natural gas drilling had ruined their water supplies. The small village in Susquehanna County became synonymous with flaming taps and jugs of muddy brown drinking water. But the media blitz angered her neighbors, the Teals, who said it ignored the economic benefits of drilling. The reporters, the activists, and the industry haven't gone away. But things have started to change.
You can see the gray smoke. Steam
wouldn't leave that gray tail.
On a recent afternoon, Victoria Schweitzer and Ron Teal are standing together on the site of a compressor station on the Teal's property. They're watching vapor rise out of a thin stack on the compressor that's helping to pump natural gas through the Tennessee pipeline. Teal and Schweitzer disagreed about what happened to their water in the past. But now they're part of a new group that agrees it's time to curb air pollution.
It got very tense around here. I mean, you were on one side of the fence or the other. You didn't sit on the fence. If you did, you got knocked off one way or the other.
The first time that Ron came to the home for a meeting, he brought a loaf of bread that his wife had made, and I thought that was pretty significant.
Water contamination is still a divisive issue. Cabot is still barred from drilling new wells within a 9-square-mile section of Dimmock. Anti-drilling activists continue to deliver water to residents who say their wells are contaminated. Rebecca Roeder, who founded the new advocacy group, says air quality is a more unifying issue.
If my water well went bad, I could choose not to drink that water. I could buy bottled water. You can't do that with air. We all breathe the same air, so everybody is equally impacted.
Roeder's group, called Breathe Easy Susquehanna County, is targeting emissions released from various stages of natural gas development. They want the industry to voluntarily go above and beyond state and federal air quality regulations. So Roeder's been setting up meetings with industry representatives. Meanwhile, she's selective about who can join. The group is open only to Susquehanna County residents who can agree on a mission statement that zeroes in on air quality and calls for respectful dialogue. Roeder specifically doesn't want people who identify as activists.
We're not part of a movement. We are a citizen group, a grassroots advocacy group advocating for the health of our community. And I don't want to be lumped in with stereotypes that would jeopardize my credibility with my community. Because when you say activist to somebody, you think of, like, you know, 50 ear piercings and anger. That's it. Lots of anger, anger, anger.
At one time, Rebecca Roeder and Victoria Schweitzer stood with members of that chorus. Schweitzer was in the second installment of Josh Fox's Gasland and sat next to activist Yoko Ono at the New York City premiere last spring. Now she says she's been getting hate mail, calling her a traitor.
I respect the work of people calling for a ban, but what good would it do for any one of us here to stand with a ban fracking sign next to this compressor station? It would be carried away in the wind.
I think that they're hurting us. I think that the position that they've taken is willfully naive.
Wendy Lin Lee is a philosophy professor at Bloomsburg University in Columbia County and a staunch anti-drilling activist. To her, the fight to ban fracking is part of a global crisis over fossil fuels and climate change. It doesn't matter if it's going on in her backyard or not. Lee believes that sitting down with the industry is equal to admitting defeat.
I can't comprehend at all how it is that they buy into the incredibly manipulative greenwash rhetoric of the middle ground or quote-unquote best practices or this whole notion of responsible drilling. We have been at ground zero in the grassroots movement, putting up resistance to this industry for years.
Rebecca Roeder says a lot of activists parachute into places like Dimock and don't understand that living with gas drilling means being in frequent contact with the industry, if only to know what's going on. Late one night last winter, the compressor station down the road from Roeder's home had a valve failure, shooting gas into the air and making a sound like a jet engine. Standing in her pajamas, Roeder left a message for the community outreach coordinator at Williams, the company that maintains and builds the pipelines and compressors.
I was calling her to say, do you have a way to communicate to those of us who now have your compressor as our neighbor?
Since then, Roeder has kept in close contact with the staff at Williams. Roeder says if that earns her criticism, she can live with that. Meanwhile, the group has started getting endorsements from local lawmakers and prominent scientists. Rebecca Roeder and Victoria Schweitzer say their new work is helping them channel the anxiety they felt when the drilling began more than 5 years ago. Now they're working on what feels like achievable goals for their community, not a long-shot crusade. Schweitzer says clearing the air in Susquehanna County would be enough.
If something happens to reduce any of the pollution, that's a huge win for everybody. So you have to fight for something. I mean, we're not going to just roll over and let them have it all.
Katie Culinary, State Impact, Pennsylvania.
For more information about the environment, go to stateimpact.npr.org/Pennsylvania. Thanks to a partnership between the University of Kentucky and a Georgetown mine, students are getting a rare opportunity to make some real noise in the mining industry. Kentucky Public Radio's Tanner Boyd has more.
5, 4, 3, 2, 1.
For many people, that sound could mean a number of different things, but for students in the University of Kentucky's Mining Engineering Department, it's the sound of the future. To clear things up, what you actually heard were members of the University of Kentucky Explosives Research Team conducting tests at their lab in Georgetown. The lab is located within the Nally and Gibson Quarry, a locally owned operation that provides limestone to the area.
We do a lot of different research where we're incorporating blast-resistant technologies for mining applications, for Department of Defense, for Homeland Security.
That was Dr. Braden Lusk, professor of mining engineering at UK. He's been with the research team since its beginnings in 2007 after partnering with Richard Hamilton of Nally and Gibson. Hamilton says the relationship between him and the university started out much more simple.
We've done some tours and students have worked here over the years. And Braden just asked if he could, you know, widen that relationship.
Since then, thousands of tests have been conducted on the mining site, ranging from new helmet designs to checking the blast resistance of numerous structures and materials. And while students are doing some real research in this high-demand field, Lusk says there are often other reasons people take an interest in the program.
Well, is that against the rules to just say we blow stuff up?
Yeah.
I mean, that's a big draw. I think if you did a poll of the people in this room and said what drew you into this type of work, you'd probably have 3 votes for we like to blow stuff up.
All joking aside, Lusk adds a real safety-first attitude is taken in his department. Buck Hawkins is the director of education at the International Society of Explosives Engineers. He says the carefulness is critical and those in the industry are well aware.
There are regulations and laws that do guide that. However, the industry self-regulates quite extraordinarily well.
And Hawkins adds, practicing what the students will go on to see in their trade is what makes the program so special.
I think it's a tremendous feat what Dr. Lusk and the folks at Nally and Gibson have accomplished, because what they do is they've got young men and women underground working with explosives from their early years of college. They don't have to wait to graduate and get a job or do an internship to actually be exposed to this sort of thing. So it's, again, it's a tremendous opportunity for the students in Lexington there to be able to do that.
With all the fun to be had in the program, Lusk says it would not have been possible without the partnership with Nally and Gibson, and thanks to them, they can have a real impact on the industry.
We're training people on how to perform research, and we're also looking at some of the real problems that people are having in industry right now. And so I think, you know, with Richard and the people at Nally and Gibson allowing us to work here and working with us, we're going to be able to come up with some solutions for those problems.
Those interested in learning more about UK's Mining Engineering Department can find more online or call 859-257-8026. Reporting for Kentucky Public Radio, I'm Tanner Boyd.
To develop the Interstate 64 corridor in Kentucky between Lexington and Louisville, a new report says the region must work with companies already based in the state. Then, as WEKU's Stu Johnson reports, they can develop the highly skilled workers needed by advanced manufacturers.
Instead of establishing a string of factories along the I-64 corridor, the BEAM report says local leaders must prioritize training the needed workforce. BEAM stands for the Bluegrass Economic Advancement Movement and has grown beyond Louisville and Lexington. It now includes 22 central Kentucky counties. Lexington Mayor Jim Gray, who's one of BEAM's founders, admits early thoughts about a series of new plants along I-64 were not well-founded.
That's an illusion to imagine that we're going to be hooked together with a band of factories. What can occur is in our regions, we will continue to grow and expand and build on these world-class manufacturers we have today.
Gray cited Toyota, Ford, and General Electric as three examples. The 68-page report also calls upon the universities of Louisville and Kentucky to double the number of engineers graduated. Plus, it wants a state-funded advanced manufacturing training center established in Georgetown. For WEKU News, I'm Stu Johnson.
This is Inside Appalachia. You're Inside Appalachia. I'm Cecilia Mason. 30 years ago, in 1983, West Virginia Public Radio started a little live radio show called Mountain Stage. The two-hour show is now carried on radio stations worldwide, has featured notable artists from around the globe, and become an ambassador of sorts for Appalachia. West Virginia Public Radio's Dave Mistich has more in this segment from his hour-long documentary commemorating Mountain Stage's 30th anniversary.
Once we got national and once we got going where we had an audience of some substance, it became a little easier and a little more interesting to try to look for folks who were emerging artists. I remember getting Lyle Lovett's first album and saying, wow, this guy's really good. And so we got him on.
Glass slippers, she held her head up high. She had that sparkle at her feet and that twinkle in her eyes. She smiled at me.
Mountain Stage began to travel more and more in the late 80s with extended stints on the road, including stops in Washington, D.C., a third stop in Spoleto, and out west as far as Texas.
Birchmere, then Charleston, South Carolina, then Kerrville, Texas. And that was all hands on deck.
As Dave McClanahan remembers it, despite using all their resources and manpower, the Mountain Stage crew had to overcome a few hurdles to make that run of shows happen.
Right before we left, the theater that we had been doing the show in, we were using some of their gear, and the fellow just right before we left told us that we couldn't take his gear. He wanted to sell it to us, and he was asking, well, an exorbitant price, but Nonetheless, we couldn't have purchased it on that short notice anyways. We came up with a way to do the house mix from the radio console and literally went on the road not having done it, just on the fly. And it worked, and that's how we did the show for many years after that. It wasn't optimal, but it did require no capital up front, and it required a lot of handstands and extra things for the tech crew to deal with. But it got the show on the air.
I pull in the alley behind a liquor store. Turn down the lights and left motor running.
At the second of two shows at the Kerrville Folk Festival in June 1988, Gross gave the nod to his old friend and schoolmate, Ray Wiley Hubbard, who says the show was already making quite the impression.
And I can't remember when I first heard it, but I was, you know, really impressed with the caliber of the artists that they had, that there weren't, you know, these just weren't flash in the pan, goober, hotshot, pop guys, that these guys, that the people they had on had a lot of integrity with their writing. And we're real musicians, so when he called me up asking to be on it, I was very, very, very flattered.
As Mountain Stage carried on, Gross and Company began to mold the show more closely to what it is today.
We started getting experience, we started getting equipment, and then we started feeling our way of, what do we want to do with this show? What is it? We had to start thinking about that. And we ultimately, over a period of years, filtered out everything but the music.
We sort of just transitioned from having that broad palette to really focusing on the music and then broadening the kinds of music that was going to be on the show.
With talent like Doc Watson, Mose Allison, Taj Mahal, Dr. John, Daniel Lanois, and James McMurtry, virtually all styles of music were being represented on Mountain Stage. Singer-songwriter Jim Lauderdale says the show helped forge a genre in and of itself.
I think it's a forerunner of what we call Americana. You know, before we called it Americana, Mountain Stage, that was kind of the vision they had with the kind of artists they were booking, is what Americana has turned out to be.
I think the Mountain Stage definitely is Americana. You can say it's Americana. You can say it isn't as well, but it would fit that description. I think quite well because what you hear on the Mountain Stage is roots music, is roots influenced, roots oriented music. So you hear mountain music, you hear bluegrass, old timey, you hear blues, the basic Americana styles.
British musician Richard Thompson first appeared on the show in February 1990 as just one name in a long list of more rock-oriented acts that helped push Mountain Stage's artistic boundaries. Broadening of the show's musical styles could even be observed in the evolution of the Mountain Stage band. In the mid to late 80s, musician and Charleston Gazette contributor Michael Lipton was starting to take notice of the show.
For me, the most interesting music was the music that Mountain Stage was bringing to town. So I started doing previews on the acts that were coming to Mountain Stage. Then I started doing stories on Mountain Stage and talking to Larry. And we became friends, and then I kind of gradually started working on the show.
Lipton first came on as an assistant to Fisher in mixing the show, but soon found himself on electric guitar with the Mountain Stage band.
I mean, there wasn't even the need for an electric guitarist that much, and then gradually more and more there was. And so I kind of, I guess in my experience, you kind of create a need for your services, and then hopefully you get hired, and that's kind of what happened. I guess I'd like to think I grew into it, you know, kind of with the show.
Although Mountain Stage was reaching nearly 100 public radio stations by the early 90s, the show received a blessing in disguise when WUGA out of Athens, Georgia, decided to drop them.
Gene Craven was then our program director and station manager. And I believe he dropped Mountain Stage for a time.
Rob Holmes, a former program director at WUGA and the host of a local music show at that station.
It didn't last long, but it was absent from our schedule for perhaps a few months. He did hear from listeners who missed it by that time, and I suspect that did include some of the members of the REM team.
Mountain Stage gained a friend in REM guitarist Peter Buck when he came on the show in April 1990 with Kevin Kinney. Put your things inside my trunk. Across the bridge, 3 miles, I'm a wandering. At the end of his set, and I knew who he was, of course. We all knew who Peter Buck was and REM was. He said to me, this is a great show. I really love this show. I'm going to see if my band wants to come play it. And I thought, yeah, right. A while later, Andy came to me and he said, we just got a call from the manager of REM. Would you like to have REM on the show? And I said, any time of day or night on any day of the week. Of course we want to have REM on the show. And by that time, we had moved back to the Culture Center. But we knew two reasons we needed to go back to the Capitol Plaza. Number one, that's where Peter Buck heard it, and he liked it, so we're going to go back there. Number two, it holds about three times as much audience as the Culture Center. So we plan to go back and do it a little bit differently. Then associate producer Linda McSparron says the Mountain Stage staff knew that REM's appearance would be a big deal, but says they had no way to fully grasp its impact on the show.
We sold the show out in 9 minutes. Tickets were being scalped for $500 in Columbus. We thought we were just being outrageously overpricing at $20 a ticket, but that's when the show, we realized, okay, we're going.
The Mountain Stage appearance was important for us to do because it was not it was certainly off of the normal beaten path for a rock band.
REM's band advisor, Burtis Downs.
It was not New York or London or L.A. We went to all those places, but we also went to Charleston, West Virginia, and did the Mountain Stage show in that spring of 91.
After the Out of Time CD, REM had decided not to tour. So all they did was Saturday Night Live, MTV's Unplugged, and Mountain Stage.
It's a high-quality show. It's on national public radio in lots and lots of markets. It's a little unconventional in a certain sense, but it's highly respected among musicians and people who listen to NPR. It has a real loyal following. We all are big supporters of WUGA here in Athens. And so it seemed like a kind of, if you're going to do the obvious stuff, it's kind of fun to throw in some things that aren't as obvious or that other people might not have thought of.
I can't stress enough the importance of REM doing our show. Just like we were fortunate to have Mrs. O'Brien send us a letter in the early days that gave us a hot rise on the show, that gave us our first national broadcast, live national broadcast on national public radio. REM put us on a map in a whole different way, because when they did the show, it was when they were having probably one of their best-selling records. Because of their appearance on the show, we were on the Today Show. We were in Rolling Stone. We were in all the music magazines.
That's when Andy had to quit calling agents, and it reversed. Everything just flip-flop, and the agents were calling him. And that's when it really changed and became a national radio show that people were, whoa, this is cool, you know. That it was always was cool, but this was like, it gave us the recognition, the high profile, what we needed.
Other guests on the bill with REM included Billy Bragg, Robin Hitchcock, and Clive Gregson and Christy Collister. Bragg says the show was a bit ahead of its time.
I think Mountain Stage was starting to get a great reputation around that time. You know, and they were putting out the CDs and everything. And, you know, at the time there weren't so many old-timey theatres that we got to play in. We were still mostly playing in rock clubs. But since then, it seems to be the idea of finding an old theatre and doing it up has caught on around the rest of America. You find more and more now you're playing in those kind of venues where people really appreciate the old space.
As Bragg points out, Mountain Stage had begun releasing Best Of compilation CDs through Blue Plate Music, a subsidiary of the John Prine-owned Old Boy Records, label co-owner and producer of the series, Al Bonetta.
It's a quality of recordings that you capture the passion, you capture the reason why these artists are doing it, the level of songs. What a way to get over a thought and a song, and Mountain Stage captures that. It's just incredible. With today's competition, the way they can make records, everybody can make a record in their home, Mountain Stage stands up to anything I've ever heard on a recording or digital delivery system.
Fisher says another co-producer of the Best Of Mountain Stage series coined a phrase that he feels accurately describes the quality of his and the show's work.
His name was Dan Einstein, and he explained it to me. He said somebody's going to look back at this material and as a lump and view it as the best collection of recorded music for this slice of time. As a collection, the work means something. He described it, and I think he's right. It's Smithsonian-grade material.
1991 proved to be a watershed year for Mountain Stage, not only because of REM's appearance and the increased attention to the show, but also because Bob Thompson came on full-time, replacing then-recently departed Eric Kitchen in the house band.
At that time, I was doing a lot more traveling with my band and doing things on the road. And so I thought, you know, this would be fun. I'd like to do this for a little while. So I thought maybe I would do it for a year or something like that, and then I would get back to what I was doing. But the longer I did it, the more I enjoyed it.
In addition to expanding the breadth of music represented on the show, Gross & Company carried on through the 90s by making Mountain Stage a haven for artists both young and old.
Quit school, Chief 17. Senator on TV calls her welfare queen. Used to be daddy's little girl. Now she needs help in this mean old world.
We've played the smallest, you know, nastiest, stickiest floored bar rooms with the smallest crowds, and we played festivals in, you know, Europe just in front of 70,000 people.
Bottle Rocket's frontman Brian Henneman says the show offers artists something rarely possible in the scheme of regular touring.
It's a great spot in that spectrum. It's cool. It's something different. It's something that reaches more people than normal. You know, how many people may hear a show that we're on Mountain Stage? You don't really know. That's the magic of radio. You know, it's like, it's going to be a lot more people than you'll fit into a little bar room in Birmingham, Alabama, or whatever.
One of the things about the show is that some of the way attitudes we have and the practices we have were formed because I was on many shows. When I had a hit song, as weird as it was, I was on every show of the day. I was on The Tonight Show, The Midnight Special. I was on The Merv Griffin Show. I was on The Rich Little Show. I was on every kind of a show like that that you could have.
And those experiences, says Gross, have left an indelible mark on how Mountain Stage has operated over the years.
What I learned was there are certain ways of treating people that I never wanted to do on Mountain Stage. And then there were other ways that I really wanted to try to emulate.
And artists who have performed on the show have certainly taken notice, like singer-songwriter Robert Earl Keane.
There's a different feeling when you deal with someone like a Mountain Stage. You know, people are truly friendly and open and glad you're there. And they don't care if you're playing some weird folk tune or you're banging on a cymbal and blowing a kazoo at the same time. It's all about, you know, the enjoyment and the entertainment and the passion behind it, not about the focus group or the numbers. It's always about, you know, bringing the personality to the airways.
Banjo virtuoso Bela Fleck echoes those sentiments.
You feel very welcomed here, and it's not an elitist kind of a situation where I don't know if we can fit you in, or I don't know if your new music, we got to hear your stuff and see if your new stuff fits. It's a very, you feel very welcomed here. It's like, no, you're part of our family, and if you have something new that you think fits, we'll give it a shot. And that's been what's happened so far. Now, I haven't shown up with any, ambient noise music based on, mosquitoes or anything like that, but we'll see what happens when that happens.
Bluegrass legend Ricky Skaggs says the show's welcoming nature fits in with their home in Appalachia.
Mountain Stage feels like family. You know, when any of us come here, we all kind of feel like we're coming, coming back, and coming to people that we love, and I think a big part of that is just that thing here in the mountains. I mean, it's community, it's family, it's friends, and that's the thing I love about Mountain Stage. It really does feel like home. I can't stress how different that is when you go and play a lot of other places.
This is Inside Appalachia. You're Inside Appalachia. I'm Cecilia Mason. The centerpiece of any Thanksgiving is the food, and for many that means turkey, stuffing, mashed potatoes, green beans, pumpkin pie, and Jell-O salad. The cooks at America's Test Kitchen are always looking for better ways to prepare traditional meals, and one of them is a West Virginia native. Bridget Lancaster was born and raised in Cross Lanes, just outside of Charleston. She's been testing recipes in the company's kitchen in Boston since 1998. Now she's one of the stars of America's Test Kitchen and Cook's Country television show seen on PBS. She spoke to West Virginia Public Radio's Beth Voorhees from WGBH in Boston about her journey from Nitro High School to America's Test Kitchen.
Well, my husband is a chef. At the time, we were thinking about, we should maybe just try living somewhere else, try a different part of the country, see what's going on. And being in the food industry, it's a little bit of a luxury because people have to eat. So there's going to be a job out there somewhere. So we put a bunch of names of cities on our dartboard, and we said, wherever we hit, we'll give it 2 years. And I was aiming for Austin, Texas, somewhere warmer. And I hit Boston, Massachusetts. And we moved up here in 1991 and have lived here ever since. Mm-hmm. So that's how we got up here, kind of very serendipitous.
We always like to ask folks from West Virginia, what was it about an upbringing in West Virginia that made you a success in your field today?
Oh, that's a great question. Well, I have to say, personally, before I get to the industry, I have to say that I look at my upbringing and I look at where I was raised and my family and the community, and I have to say how lucky I was. I truly believe that in West Virginia, a lot of that still is there. There's that sense of community and a whole bunch of people looking out for each other. And it's gone in a lot of different areas, a lot of other areas of the country. But it was a great place to grow up. And I think that gave me a sense of myself. I never had really a sense of fear growing up, the world out, wherever, because I had this great school system, this great community, the Cross Lanes community, a wonderful church, my family. We always felt so secure. And I think that gave me a lot of confidence growing up to pursue things, maybe to go out on a limb and do things that I never thought I would be doing, just like, who would have ever thought I would be here? So I think that that played a big part. Now, professionally, I have to say that I pretty much owe my entire career to my mother, who was a very famous cook amongst my friends and family. I had a lot of friends, and I think that was because of my mom. It had nothing to do with me.
She was a great cook, obviously.
Oh, she still is. And, yeah, she was just, you know, always, there was always something from scratch going on. She was a project cook, so there would be these big, elaborate meals. And she would always feed my friends that came home with me after school.
She's still in Cross Lanes?
She is still in Cross Lanes, and she's still cooking. Now, she's roped my dad in on the action, too, so he does most of the grilling.
Yeah. So America's Test Kitchen, I am familiar with certainly the public TV show, mm-hmm. and I'm familiar with Cook's Country magazine and Cook's Illustrated. They're very, very good magazines. How did you hook up with these folks?
It really was a case of knowing somebody who knew somebody who knew somebody. I was working as a pastry chef in Boston at the time, and I didn't really like my hours, you know, going at 3 in the morning. And I'd be out by 9 o'clock in the morning. And then I had a second job as well because a girl's got to eat. And the job at the restaurant didn't pay enough. So I was also working at a retail store selling kitchen supplies. And there was another person who worked there, and she was a test cook at Cook's Illustrated magazine. And she said, you know, we're looking for another test cook. You know, the hours are 9 to 5, no weekends. No getting up in the middle of the night, coming in early in the morning. You know, why don't you come over and give us a try? So I went to the office, and they set out a bench test for me. So they had, you know, all these different things. I had to make cookies. I had to chop a bunch of vegetables, show how I could make an omelet, all these different aspects of the job just to make sure that, you know, I wasn't all talk. And we shook hands. We said, okay, well, thank you very much. And they called me back, and they said, when can you start? And that was in 98. So I started off as the test cook there, one of three at the time. We now have close to 30 and have moved up ever since. And, you know, it's been a tremendous company because we seem to have a new project that is growing every week. You know, of course, social media is kind of the where we're growing right now. So it's never boring. It's always changing. And there's always an opportunity around the corner to do something different.
And America's Test Kitchen, just like the name implies, you folks sit around, look at recipes, write recipes, cook recipes, and see what really works for the home cook.
That's it. I mean, a lot of people laugh when I'm complaining and I say, oh, I had to taste 15 batches of brownies today. You know, it sounds like such a terrible job. They're getting out the tiny violins for me. But, yeah, that's what we do. We beat the heck out of a recipe until it is foolproof. You know, our slogan is recipes that work. And we start at the very beginning with this idea of a recipe. We identify the problems. And then at every step, we have a test and a control. So it's almost a scientific approach to developing these recipes. So it doesn't matter the kitchen that you're working in or the equipment or the, you know, the time. As long as you follow the recipe, it'll work.
Mm-hmm. Will you be cooking on Thanksgiving, or are you going to come down and see your mom?
Oh, I would love to come down and see my mom, but no, my husband is working. He's a chef, so we don't really get to travel too much on Thanksgiving.
Oh, and, sure.
So we have a pretty late Thanksgiving meal. He comes home from cooking for everybody else in the community, and then he gets a second meal at the house. He's like, really, turkey again? but it's our first turkey of the day, so.
Mm-hmm.
But looking forward to it. It's my favorite holiday.
Bridget Lancaster, thank you very, very much for taking time to speak with us. I appreciate it.
Thank you, and happy Thanksgiving.
Happy Thanksgiving to you, too.
Despite what many people think, there is still a fairly sizable tobacco growing industry in Kentucky, but it's nothing like the heyday of tobacco growing in the middle of the last century. Western Kentucky University Folk Studies professor Dr. Anne Farrell spent the past 8 years researching and writing her new book, Burley, Kentucky, Tobacco in a New Century.
There are still many, many people growing tobacco in Kentucky. In 2007, there were over 8,000 farmers still raising tobacco in Kentucky. In 1959, tobacco was grown on 80% of Kentucky farms. And now in 2007, it was about 10%.
Farrell's research included a full year on a farm, helping with the planting, growing, and cutting. She says for those still in the business, adaptation is and always has been the key.
The first farmer that I interviewed, I said, can you walk me through, you know, tell me what happens in tobacco from, you know, through the whole yearly cycle of all the things that you have to do? And he said, do you want to know how we do it now or how we did it in the old days? Because it's changed so much.
Still, Farrell says there are few small or part-time tobacco farmers anymore. And she says a big problem for a lot of growers is that for them, tobacco farmer isn't just what they do, it's who they are, and they can't see themselves doing anything else. This is Inside Appalachia. You're Inside Appalachia. I'm Cecilia Mason. Most West Virginians and Marylanders are not aware that they share one of the most famously contested state borders in the country. If you're driving along U.S. Route 219 in Tucker County, West Virginia, near the Maryland line, you're bound to pass by the turnoff for the Fairfax Stone Historical Monument State Park, which lies at the origin of this controversy. The Garrett County, Maryland, Preston County, West Virginia boundary line was such a controversial issue that the dispute was taken all the way to the Supreme Court, which had to make the final decision on the border back in 1910. The West Virginia Surveyors Historical Society has been conducting a number of new surveys in the past 2 years, and as Dan Schultz reports, is uncovering some of the lost history that played an important role in the landmark case between the two states.
Hey, I'm Don Teeter. We're camped here with the West Virginia Surveyors Historical Society at Blackwater Falls State Park Campground.
Don Teeter and the crew are only a 20-minute drive from the Fairfax Stone Historical Monument State Park, which sits just off U.S. Route 219 near the West Virginia-Maryland border. The Fairfax Stone is about the size of a refrigerator and has a plaque on it explaining that the stone marks the headspring of the Potomac River. So why is this important? Well, as it turns out, the monument probably doesn't mark the true headspring of the Potomac. Way back in the 1730s, the highest court in Britain, which ruled the American colonies at the time, ordered a survey crew to determine where the Potomac River began. This was done on account of Lord Fairfax, who had been granted all of the land between the Potomac and the Rappahannock Rivers, and was naturally eager to stake his claim. Dave Ingram, one of the historical surveyors, explains how the expedition unfolded.
What happened on the Potomac River side is that a survey crew went out, started down around Harper's Ferry, as best I can tell, and started going upstream, and every time they came to a major fork in the river, they decided, okay, are we going to go right or left? Which stream is stronger? That was their logic for going to the ultimate headspring of the Potomac. They kept on going and going and going and ultimately came out where the Fairfax Stone is recognized today.
So, in 1746, a stone was actually placed in this spot, officially marking the western extent of the Fairfax land grant. Unfortunately, this would set the stage for a future border dispute between Maryland and Virginia, and later West Virginia. The Fairfax Stone supposedly marked the headspring of the Potomac River, which in turn marked the southernmost point of Maryland's western border, which is known as the Deacon's Line. By the 1860s, Maryland had several boundary commissions formed to redetermine the Deacon's Line, which it claimed was not a valid boundary line, because it was neither a straight line nor had it ever been officially surveyed. The border dispute was not settled before the Civil War came along, and so the new state of West Virginia inherited the issue. Decades passed, and Maryland continued to dispute the Deacon's Line as the official boundary between Western Maryland and West Virginia.
So eventually, all the efforts to resolve it broke down, and that's when the early 1890s a lawsuit was filed. And of course, it took almost 20 years for the lawsuit to finally work its way through, which is pretty typical of that kind of litigation.
The Honorable, the Chief Justice, and the Associate Justices of the Supreme Court of the
United
States.
So the lawsuit went to the U.S. Supreme Court, which arbitrates disputes between states.
In the meantime, West Virginia was surveying, Maryland was surveying, they were measuring the various different streams, they were measuring the elevations of the different springs, making arguments for where the true head spring of the Potomac was.
So while the lawsuit wound its way around to the Supreme Court, Maryland decided it would find the true head spring of the Potomac. And supposedly, the Maryland surveyors found it.
Well, the Potomac stone was where the surveyor for Maryland, William McCullough Brown, claimed was the true head spring of the Potomac River. He called it the Potomac Spring, and he surveyed in the 1890s, finishing up his surveys in 1897 for Maryland to make Maryland's case that the Fairfax Stone was in the wrong place, belonged further to the west, and that a sizable strip of ground should have been in Maryland instead of West Virginia.
So now there were two stones signifying two different borders between Maryland and West Virginia. In 1910, 13 years after the Potomac Stone was placed, and 164 years after the Fairfax Stone was set, the Supreme Court finally made its decision on the case in favor of West Virginia.
When the Supreme Court made their decision, they in essence said that William McCullough Brown's survey could be correct with regard to the true head spring of the Potomac, which could be at the Potomac Spring, the Potomac Stone. Then they also said, it doesn't matter. If you had brought your lawsuit 125 years ago, we might have agreed with you, but we're not going to change it now, because that's what the people have been treating as the boundary. They've been occupying to that, it's been recognized, and that after something's been long recognized, you don't just turn the world upside down and decide to fix it.
The dispute was settled. The Supreme Court decided that the Deacon's Line had been the de facto border for over a century, and it was not going to change because of a surveying error. In effect, this decision solidified the place of the Fairfax Stone in the nation's history. The Potomac Stone, however, was left to be forgotten until this past year, when the West Virginia Surveyors Historical Society got together and found the stone using the original survey notes they unearthed in the Maryland State Archives. The historical surveyors are now working to recover the Potomac Stone and preserve it for posterity. It's hard to believe that events set in motion before these states even existed could cause a dispute that lasted into the next two centuries, and it's still captivating people today. I asked Dave Ingram how someone like himself gets interested in a project like this.
I'm a land surveyor from Virginia and got involved or interested in this a long time ago when I got interested in the Fairfax survey. I just get intrigued by this kind of stuff, dig into it, and won't let it go. And this is from a guy that when I was in high school and college, my two least favorite subjects were foreign language and history. And now I like history.
This story was produced by Dan Schultz of the Traveling 219 Project, a production of Allegheny Mountain Radio with support from the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, the West Virginia Humanities Council, and AmeriCorps Vista. To learn more, go to traveling219.com or Facebook. We had help producing Inside Appalachia this week from Morehead State Public Radio in Morehead, Kentucky, WMMT in Whitesburg, Kentucky, WEKU in Richmond, Kentucky, WETS in Johnson City, Tennessee, Allegheny Mountain Radio in Dunmore, West Virginia, State Impact, Pennsylvania, the Allegheny Front, and Kentucky Public Radio. Our opening theme music is by Michael Lipton. Our closing theme music is by Al Petaway and Amy White from their CD, Land of the Sky, from Maggie's Music. We'd love to hear from you. You can email us at feedback@wvpublic.org. You can also address your letters to Inside Appalachia, in care of West Virginia Public Broadcasting, 600 Capitol Street, Charleston, West Virginia, 25301. The Inside Appalachia podcast is available on iTunes, Stitcher, and at our new website, wvpublic.org. I'm Cecilia Mason. Inside Appalachia is a news and public affairs production of West Virginia Public Broadcasting.